Chapter 19. Surrey, England. At the Stratford Clinic, it was just after 10 in the evening when Amira Asaf came out of the elevator and set off down the fourth-floor corridor. Rounding the first corner, she spotted the bodyguard sitting on a chair outside Miss Martinson's room. He looked up as Amira approached and closed the book he was reading.
"I need to make sure she's sleeping comfortably," Amira said.
The bodyguard nodded and got to his feet. He wasn't surprised by Amira's request. She'd been stopping by the room every night at this time for the past month. She opened the door and went inside. The bodyguard followed after her and closed the door behind him. A lamp, dimmed to its lowest setting, was burning softly. Amira went to the side of the bed and looked down. Miss Martinson was sound asleep. Hardly a surprise, Amira had given her twice her usual dosage of sedative. She'd be out for several more hours. Amira adjusted the blankets, then opened the top drawer of the bedside table. The gun, a silenced Walther 9mm, was precisely where she had left it earlier that afternoon, while Miss Martinson was still in the solarium. She seized the weapon by the grip, then spun round and leveled the gun at the bodyguard's chest. He reached inside his jacket in a lightning-fast movement. Before his hand emerged, Amira fired twice, the double tap of a trained killer. Both shots struck the upper chest. The bodyguard tumbled backward onto the floor. Amira stood over him and fired two more shots. She drew a series of deep breaths to quell the intense wave of nausea that washed over her. Then she went to the telephone and dialed an internal hospital extension.
"Would you please ask Hamid to come up to Miss Martinson's room? There's some linen that needs to be collected before the truck leaves."
She hung up the phone, then took the dead man by the arms and dragged him into the bathroom. The carpet was smeared with blood. Amira was not concerned by this. Her intention was not to conceal the crime, only to delay its discovery by a few hours. There was a knock at the door.
"Yes, it's Hamid."
She unlocked the door and opened it. Hamid wheeled in a laundry cart.
"You all right?"
Amira nodded. Hamid wheeled the cart next to the bed while Amira pulled away the blankets and sheets. Miss Martinson, frail and scarred, lay motionless. Hamid lifted her by her torso, Amira by her legs, and together they lowered her gently into the laundry cart. Amira concealed her beneath a layer of sheets. She went out into the corridor to make certain it was clear, then looked back at Hamid and motioned for him to join her. Hamid rolled the cart out of the room and started toward the elevator. Amira closed the door, then inserted her passkey into the lock and snapped it off. She met Hamid at the elevator and pressed the call button. The wait seemed an eternity. When finally the doors opened, they wheeled the cart into the empty chamber. Amira pressed the button for the ground floor, and they sunk slowly downward. The ground floor foyer was deserted. Hamid went out first and turned to the right toward the doorway that led to the rear courtyard. Amira followed after him. Outside, a van was idling with its rear cargo doors open. On the side was stenciled the name of a local laundry supply company. The usual driver was lying in a stand of beech trees 2 miles from the hospital with a bullet in his neck. Hamid lifted the laundry bag out of the cart and placed it gently into the back of the van, then closed the doors and climbed into the front passenger seat. Amira watched the van roll off. Then she went back inside and walked to the head nurse's station. Ginger was on duty.
"I'm not feeling terribly well tonight, Ginger. Think you can get by without me?"
"No problem, love. Need a ride?"
Amira shook her head.
"I can manage on the bike. See you tomorrow night."
Amira went to the staff locker room. Before stripping off her uniform, she hid the gun inside her backpack. Then she changed into jeans, a heavy woolen sweater, and a leather jacket. A moment later, she was walking across the rear courtyard with her bag across her back. She climbed on the bike and started the engine, then accelerated out of the courtyard. As she rounded the back of the old mansion, she glanced up at Miss Martinson's window, one light burning softly, no sign of trouble. She raced along the drive and rolled to a stop at the guardhouse. The man on duty bid her a good night, then opened the gate. Amira turned onto the road and twisted the throttle. 10 minutes later, she was racing along the A-24 motorway, heading south to the sea. Chapter 20. Marseille. Gabriel slipped into his stateroom and closed the door. He went to the closet and peeled back a parcel of loose carpet, exposing the door of the floor safe. He worked the tumbler and lifted the lid. Inside were 3 handguns, a Beretta 92FS, a Jericho 941PS police special, and a Barak SP-21. Carefully, he lifted each of the weapons out and laid them on the bed. The Beretta and the Jericho were both 9mm weapons. The magazine for the Beretta had a 15-round capacity, the Jericho 16. The Barak, squat, black, and ugly, fired a larger and more destructive .45 caliber round, though it held only 8 shots. He field-stripped the guns, beginning with the Beretta and ending with the Barak. Each weapon appeared in perfect working order. He reassembled and loaded the weapons, then tested the weight and balance of each, deliberating over which to use. The hit was not likely to be a covert and quiet affair. It would probably take place on a busy street, perhaps in broad daylight. Making certain Khaled was dead was the first priority. For that, Gabriel needed power and reliability. He selected the Barak as his primary weapon, and the Beretta 92FS as his backup. He also decided he would work without a silencer. A silencer made the weapon too difficult to conceal and too unwieldy to draw and fire. Besides, what was the point of using a silencer if the act was witnessed by a crowd of people on the street? He went into the bathroom and stood for a moment before the mirror, examining his face. Then he opened the medicine cabinet and removed a pair of scissors, a razor, and a can of shaving cream. He trimmed the beard down to stubble, then removed the rest with the razor. His hair was still dyed gray. Nothing to be done about that. He stripped off his clothes and showered quickly, then went back into the stateroom to dress. He pulled on his underwear and socks, then a pair of dark blue denim trousers and rubber-soled suede brogues. He attached his radio unit to the waistband of his jeans on the left hip, then ran a wire to his ear and a second one to his left wrist. After securing the wires with strips of black tape, he pulled on a long-sleeved black shirt. The Beretta he shoved down the waistband of his jeans at the small of his back. The Barak was compact enough to fit in the pocket of his leather jacket. His GPS tracking beacon, a small disc about the size of a 1 euro coin, he slipped into the front pocket of his jeans. He sat on the end of the bed and waited. 5 minutes later, there was a knock at the door. The clock read 2:12 a.m.
"How certain are your experts?"
The Prime Minister looked up at the bank of video monitors and waited for an answer. In one of the monitors was Lev's image. The Director General of Shabak, Moshe Yariv, occupied the second. General Amos Charette, Chief of Amman, the third.
"There's no doubt whatsoever," replied Lev. "The man in the photo given to us by Mahmoud Arwish is the same man who just walked into the apartment building in Marseille. All we need now is your approval for the final phase of the operation to commence. You have it. Give the order to Fidelity."
"Yes, Prime Minister."
"I assume you'll be able to hear the radio traffic. Fidelity will send it to us via the secure link. We'll maintain operational control until the final second."
"Send it here too," the Prime Minister said. "I don't want to be the last to know."
Then he pressed a button on his desk, and the 3 screens turned to black. The motorbike was a Piaggio X9 Evolution, charcoal gray, with a twist-and-go throttle and a listed top speed of 160 kilometers per hour, though Yakov, on a practice escape run the previous day, had topped out at 190. The saddle sloped severely downward from back to front, so that the passenger sat several inches above the driver, which made it a perfect bike for an assassin, though surely its designers had not had that in mind when they'd conceived it. The engine, as usual, fired without hesitation. Yakov headed toward the spot along the quay where the helmeted figure of Gabriel awaited him. Gabriel climbed onto the passenger seat and settled in.
"Take me to the Boulevard Saint-Remy."
"You sure?"
"One pass," he
he said. I want to see it. Yakov banked hard to the left and raced up the hill. It was a good building on the Corniche, with a marble floor in the lobby and an elevator that worked most of the time. The flats facing the street had a fine view of the Nile. The ones on the back looked down into the walled grounds of the American Embassy. It was a building for foreigners and rich Egyptians, another world from the drab cinderblock tenement in Heliopolis where Zubair lived. But then, being a policeman in Egypt didn't pay much, even if you were a secret policeman working for the Mukhabarat. He took the stairs. They were wide and curved, with a faded runner held in place by tarnished brass fittings. The apartment was on the top floor, the 10th. Zubair cursed silently as he trod upward. 2 packs of Cleopatra cigarettes a day had ravaged his lungs. 3 times he had to pause on a landing to catch his breath. It took him a good 5 minutes to reach the flat. He pressed his ear to the door and heard no sound from within. Hardly surprising, Zubair had followed the Englishman last night during a liquor-soaked excursion through the hotel bars and nightclubs along the river. Zubair was confident he was still sleeping. He reached into his pocket and came out with the key. The Mukhabarat had a fine collection, diplomats, dissidents, Islamists, and especially foreign journalists. He inserted the key into the lock and turned, then pushed open the door and stepped inside. The flat was cool and dark, the curtains tightly drawn against the early morning sun. Zubair had been in the flat many times and found his way to the bedroom without bothering to switch on the lights. Quinnell slept soundly in sheets soaked with sweat. On the stagnant air hung the overpowering stench of whiskey. Zubair drew his gun and walked slowly across the room toward the foot of the bed. After a few paces, his right foot fell upon something small and hard. Before he could relieve the downward pressure, something snapped, emitting a sharp crack. In the deep silence of the room, it sounded like a splintering tree limb. Zubair looked down and saw that he'd stepped on Quinnell's wristwatch. The Englishman, in spite of his drunkenness, sat bolt upright in bed. Shit, thought Zubair. He was not a professional assassin. He'd hoped to kill Quinnell in his sleep.
What the devil are you doing in here?
I bring a message from our friend, Zubair said calmly.
I don't want anything more to do with him.
The feeling is mutual.
So then what in God's name are you doing in my flat?
Zubair raised the gun. A moment later, he let himself out of the flat and started back down the stairs. Halfway down, he was breathing like a marathoner and sweating hard. He stopped and leaned against the balustrade. The damned Cleopatras. If he didn't quit soon, they'd be the death of him. Marseille, 5:22 a.m. The door of the apartment house swings open. A figure steps into the street. Dina's verbal alert is heard in the operations center of King Saul Boulevard and in Jerusalem by Shamron and the Prime Minister. And it is also heard in the dirty esplanade along the Cour Belsance, where Gabriel and Yakov are sitting on the edge of a stagnant fountain, surrounded by drug addicts and immigrants with nowhere else to sleep.
"Who is it?" Gabriel asks.
"The girl," Dina says.
Then she adds quickly,
"Khaled's girl."
"Which way is she going?"
"North, toward the Place de la Prefecture."
There follows several empty seconds of dead air. In Jerusalem, Shamron is pacing the carpet in front of the Prime Minister's desk, and waiting anxiously for Gabriel's order.
"Don't try it," he murmurs. "If she spots the watcher, she'll warn Khaled, and you'll lose him. Let her go."
10 more seconds pass before Gabriel's voice comes back on the air.
"It's too risky," he whispers. "Let her go."
In Ramallah, the meeting broke up at dawn. Yasser Arafat was in high good humor. To those in attendance, he seemed a bit like the Arafat of old, the Arafat who could argue ideology and strategy all night with his closest comrades, then sit down for a meeting with a head of state. As his lieutenants filed out of the room, Arafat motioned for Mahmoud Arwish to remain.
"It's begun," Arafat said. "Now we can only hope that Allah has blessed Khaled's sacred endeavor."
It is your endeavor too, Abu Ammar.
True, said Arafat. And it wouldn't have been possible without you, Mahmud.
Arwish nodded cautiously. Arafat held him in his gaze.
You played your role well, said Arafat. Your clever deception of the Israelis almost makes up for your betrayal of me and the rest of the Palestinian people. I'm tempted to overlook your crime, but I cannot.
Arwish felt his chest tighten. Arafat smiled.
Did you really think your treachery would ever be forgiven?
My wife, Arwish stammered. The Jews made me... Arafat waved his hand dismissively.
You sound like a child, Mahmud. Don't compound your humiliation by begging for your life.
Just then, the door swung open, and two uniformed security men stepped into the room, guns at the ready. Arwish tried to get his sidearm out of its holster, but a rifle butt slammed into his kidney, and a burst of blinding pain sent him to the floor.
Today, you die the death of a collaborator, Arafat said. A death fit for a dog.
The security men hauled Arwish to his feet, and Frog marched him out of the office and down the stairs. Arafat went to the window and looked down into the courtyard as Arwish and the security men emerged into view. Another rifle butt to the kidney drove Arwish to the ground for a second time. Then the firing began, slow and rhythmic. They started with the feet and worked their way slowly upward. The mukata echoed with the popping of the Kalashnikovs and the screams of the dying traitor. To Arafat, it was a most satisfying sound. The sound of a revolution, the sound of revenge. When the screaming stopped, there was one final shot to the head. Arafat drew the blind. One enemy had been dealt with. Soon, another would meet with a similar fate. He switched off the lamp and sat there in the half-light, waiting for the next update. Chapter 21. Marseille. Later, when it was over, Dina would search in vain for any symbolism in the time Khaled chose to make his appearance. As for the exact words she used to convey this news to the teams, she had no memory of it, though they were captured for eternity on audio tape.
It's him. He's on the street, heading south toward the park.
All those who heard Dina's summons were struck by its composure and lack of emotion. So tranquil was her delivery that for an instant Shamron did not comprehend what had just happened. Only when he heard the roar of Yakov's motorbike, followed by the sound of Gabriel's rapid breathing, did he understand that Khaled was about to get his due. Within 5 seconds of hearing Dina's voice, Yakov and Gabriel had pulled on their helmets and were racing eastward at full throttle toward the Cour Belsance. At the Place de la Préfecture, Yakov leaned the bike hard to the right and sped across the square toward the entrance of the Boulevard Saint-Remy. Gabriel clung to Yakov's waist with his left hand. His right was shoved into his coat pocket and wrapped around the chunky grip of the barak. It was just beginning to get light, but the street was still in shadow. Gabriel saw Khaled for the first time, walking along the pavement like a man late for an important meeting. The bike slowed suddenly. Yakov had a decision to make: cross over to the wrong side of the street and approach Khaled from behind, or stay on the right side of the street and loop around for the kill. Gabriel spurred him to the right with a jab of the gun barrel. Yakov twisted the throttle, and the bike shot forward. Gabriel fastened his eyes on Khaled. The Palestinian was walking faster. Just then, a dark gray Mercedes car nosed out of a cross street and blocked their path. Yakov slammed on the brakes to avoid collision, then blew his horn and waved at the Mercedes to get out of the way. The driver, a young Arab-looking man, stared coldly back at Yakov and punished him for his recklessness by inching slowly out of their path. By the time Yakov was underway again, Khaled had turned the corner and disappeared from Gabriel's sight. Yakov sped to the end of the street and turned left into the Boulevard André Aune. It rose sharply away from the old port, toward the looming tower of the Church of Notre Dame de la Garde. Khaled had already crossed the street and at that moment was slipping into the entrance of a covered passageway. Gabriel had used the computer program to memorize the route of every street in the district. He knew that the passageway led to a flight of steeply pitched stone steps called the Montée de l'Oratoire. Khaled had rendered the motorbike useless.
"Stop here," Gabriel said. "Don't move."
Gabriel leapt from his bike and, with his helmet still on his head, followed the path Khaled had taken. There were no lights in the passage, and for a few paces in the center, Gabriel was in pitch darkness. At the opposite end, he emerged back into the dusty pink light. The steps began wide and very old, with a painted metal handrail down the middle. To Gabriel's left was the khaki-colored stucco facade of an apartment house. To his right, a tall limestone wall overhung with olive trees and flowering vines. The steps curved to the left. As Gabriel came around the corner, he saw Khaled again. He was halfway to the top and bounding upward at a trot. Gabriel started to draw the baraque, but stopped himself. At the top of the steps was another apartment building. If Gabriel missed Khaled, the errant round would almost certainly plunge into the building. He could hear voices through his earpiece, Dina asking Yakov what was going on, Yakov telling Dina about the car that had blocked their way and the flight of steps that had forced them to separate.
"Can you see him?"
"No."
"How long has he been out of sight?"
"A few seconds."
"Where's Khaled going? Why is he walking so far? Where's his protection? I don't like it. I'm going to tell him to back off."
"Leave him to it."
Khaled gained the top and disappeared from sight. Gabriel took the steps two at a time and arrived no more than 10 seconds after Khaled had. Confronting him was a V-shaped intersection of two streets. One of them, the one to Gabriel's right, ran up the hill directly toward the front of the church. It was empty of cars or pedestrians. Gabriel hurried to his left and looked up the second street. There was no sign of Khaled here either, only a pair of red taillights receding rapidly into the distance.
"Excuse me, monsieur, are you lost?"
Gabriel turned and raised the visor of his helmet. She was standing at the head of the stairs, young, no more than 30, with large brown eyes and short dark hair. She had spoken to him in French. Gabriel responded in the same language.
"No, I'm not lost. Perhaps you're looking for someone."
"And why are you, an attractive woman, speaking to a strange man wearing a motorcycle helmet?"
He took a step toward her. She held her ground, but Gabriel detected a trace of apprehension in her dark gaze.
"No, I'm not looking for anyone."
"Are you sure? I could have sworn you were looking for someone."
She tilted her head slightly to one side.
"Perhaps you're looking for your wife."
Gabriel felt as though the back of his neck was ablaze. He looked at the woman's face more carefully and realized he'd seen it before. She was the woman who'd come to the apartment with Khaled. His right hand tightened its grip on the Barak pistol.
"Her name is Leah, isn't it? She lives in a psychiatric hospital in the south of England. At least she used to. The Stratford Clinic, wasn't that the name of it? She was registered under the name of Lee Martinson."
Gabriel lunged forward and seized the woman by the throat.
"What have you done to her? Where is she?"
"We have her," the woman gasped. "But I don't know where she is."
Gabriel pushed her backward toward the top of the steps.
"Where is she?"
He repeated the question in Arabic.
"Answer me! Don't speak to me in French. Speak to me in your real language. Speak to me in Arabic. I'm telling you the truth. So, you can speak Arabic. Where is she? Answer me or you're going down."
He pushed her a fraction of an inch closer to the edge. Her hand reached back for the handrail, but found only air. Gabriel shook her once, violently.
"If you kill me, you'll destroy yourself and your wife. I am your only hope."
"And if I do as you say?"
"You'll save her life."
"What about mine?" She left the question unanswered.
"Tell the rest of your team to back off. Tell them to leave Marseille immediately. Otherwise, we'll tell the French that you're here, and that will only make the situation worse."
He looked over her shoulder and saw Yakov coming slowly up the steps toward him. Gabriel, with his left hand, signaled for him to stop. Just then, Dina came on the air.
"Let her go, Gabriel. We'll find Leah. Don't play it Khaled's way."
Gabriel looked back into the girl's eyes.
"And if I tell them to back off?"
"I'll take you to her."
Gabriel shook her again.
"So you do know where she is?"
"No! We'll be told where to go.
One destination at a time, very small steps. If we miss one deadline, your wife dies. If your agents try to follow us, your wife dies. If you kill me, your wife dies. If you do exactly what we say, she'll live. And what happens to me? Hasn't she suffered enough? Save your wife, Alon. Come with me and do exactly as I say. It's your only chance.
He looked down the steps and saw Yakov shaking his head. Dina was whispering in his ear,
Please, Gabriel, tell her no.
He looked into her eyes. Shamron had trained him to read the emotions of others, to tell truthfulness from deception. And in the dark eyes of Khaled's girl, he saw only the abiding forthrightness of a fanatic, the belief that past suffering justified any act, no matter how cruel. He also noticed an unsettling tranquility. She was trained, this girl, not merely indoctrinated. Her training would make her a worthy opponent, but it was her fanaticism that would leave her vulnerable. Did they really have Leah? He had no reason to doubt it. Khaled had destroyed an embassy in the heart of Rome. Surely he could manage to kidnap an infirm woman from an English mental hospital. To abandon Leah now, after all she had suffered, was unthinkable. Perhaps she would die. Perhaps they both would. Perhaps, if they were lucky, Khaled might permit them to die together. He had played it well, Khaled. He had never intended to kill Gabriel in Venice. The Milan dossier had been only the opening gambit in an elaborate plot to lure Gabriel here, to this spot in Marseille, and to present him with a path he had no choice but to follow. Fidelity nudged him forward. He pulled her away from the edge of the stairs and released his grip on her throat. Back off, Gabriel said directly into his wrist microphone. Leave Marseille. When Yakov shook his head, Gabriel snapped, Do as I say. A car came down the hill from the direction of the church, the Mercedes that had blocked their path a few minutes earlier on the Boulevard Saint-Remy. It stopped in front of them. The girl opened the back door and got in. Gabriel looked one final time at Yakov, then climbed in after her.
He's off the air, Lev said. His beacon has been stationary for 5 minutes.
His beacon, thought Shamron, is lying in a Marseille gutter. Gabriel had vanished from their screens. All the planning, all the preparation, and Khaled had beaten them with the oldest of Arab ploys, a hostage. Is it true about Leah? Shamron asked.
London station has called the security officer several times. So far they haven't been able to raise him.
That means they've got her, Shamron said, and I suspect we have a dead security agent somewhere inside the Stratford Clinic.
If that's all true, a very serious storm is going to break in England in the next few minutes.
There was a bit too much composure in Lev's voice for Shamron's taste, but then Lev always did place a high premium on self-control.
We need to reach out to our friends in M15 and the Home Office to keep things as quiet as possible for as long as possible. We also need to bring the Foreign Ministry into the picture. The ambassador will have to do some serious hand-holding.
Agreed, Shamron said. But I'm afraid there's something we have to do first.
He looked at his wristwatch. It was 7:28 a.m., local time, 6:28 in France, 12 hours until the anniversary of the evacuation of Beit Said.
But we can't just leave him here, Dina said.
He's not here any longer, Yakov replied. He's gone. He was the one who made the decision to go with her. He gave us the order to evacuate, and so has Tel Aviv. We have no other choice. We're leaving.
There must be something we can do to help him.
You can't be of any help to him if you're sitting in a French jail.
Yakov raised his wrist microphone to his lips and ordered the IN teams to pull out. Dina went reluctantly down onto the dock and loosened the lines. When the last line was untied, she climbed back onto Fidelity and stood with Yakov atop the flying bridge as he guided the vessel into the channel. As they passed the Fort of St. Nicholas, she went back down the companionway to the salon. She sat down at the communications pod, typed in a command to access the memory, then set the time code for 6:12 a.m. A few seconds later, she heard her own voice.
It's him. He's on the street, heading south toward the park.
She listened to it all again, Yakov and Gabriel wordlessly mounting the bike, Yakov firing the engine and accelerating away, the sound of tires locking up and skidding along the asphalt of the boulevard Saint-Rémy. Gabriel's voice, calm and without emotion.
Stop here. Don't move.
20 seconds later, the woman.
Excuse me, monsieur. Are you lost?
Stop. How long had Khaled spent planning it? Years, she thought. He had dropped the clues for her to find, and she had followed them. From Beit Said to Buenos Aires, from Istanbul to Rome. And now Gabriel was in their hands. They would kill him. And it was her fault. She pressed play and listened again to Gabriel's quarrel with a Palestinian woman, then picked up the satellite phone and raised King Saul Boulevard on the secure link.
I need a voice identification.
You have a recording?
Yes.
Quality?
Dina explained the circumstances of the intercept.
Play the recording, please.
She pressed play.
If we miss one deadline, your wife dies. If your agents try to follow us, your wife dies. If you kill me, your wife dies. If you do exactly what we say, she'll live.
Stop.
Stand by, please.
2 minutes later.
No match on file.
Martineau met Abu Sadiq one last time on the Boulevard Dauphiné at the base of the broad steps that led to the Gare St. Charles. Abu Sadiq was dressed in Western clothing. Neat gabardine trousers and a pressed cotton shirt. He told Martineau a boat had just left the port at great haste.
What was it called?
Abu Sadiq answered.
Fidelity,
Martineau repeated. An interesting choice. He turned and started trudging up the steps, Abu Sadiq at his side.
The Shaheeds have been given their final orders, Abu Sadiq said. They'll proceed to their target as scheduled. Nothing can be done to stop them now. And you?
The midday ferry to Algiers.
They arrived at the top of the steps. The train station was brown and ugly, and in a state of severe disrepair.
I must say, Abu Sadiq said, that I will not miss this place. Go to Algiers and bury yourself deep. We'll bring you back to the West Bank when it's safe.
After today, he shrugged, it will never be safe.
Martineau shook Abu Sadiq's hand.
Ma salama.
Assalamu alaikum, brother Khaled.
Abu Sadiq turned and headed down the steps. Martineau entered the train station and paused in front of the departure board. The 8:15 TGV for Paris was departing from track F. Martineau crossed the terminal and went onto the platform. He walked alongside the train until he found his carriage, then climbed aboard. Before going to his seat, he went to the toilet. He stood for a long time in front of the mirror, examining his own reflection in the glass. The Yves Saint Laurent jacket, the dark blue end-on-end shirt, the designer spectacles. Paul Martineau, Frenchman of distinction, archaeologist of note. But not today. Today, Martineau was Khaled, son of Sabri, grandson of Sheikh Assad. Khaled, avenger of past wrongs, sword of Palestine.
The Shaheeds have been given their final orders. Nothing can be done to stop them now.
Another order had been given. The man who would meet Abu Sadiq in Algiers that evening would kill him. Martineau had learned from the mistakes of his ancestors. He would never allow himself to be undone by an Arab traitor. A moment later, he was sitting in his first-class seat as the train eased out of the station and headed north through the Muslim slums of Marseille. Paris was 539 miles away, but the high-speed TGV would cover the distance in a little more than 3 hours, a miracle of Western technology and French ingenuity, Khaled thought. Then he closed his eyes and was soon asleep.